Good afternoon. So, last time we talked about moving beyond locking to some more advanced mechanisms to coordinate between threads. We started with counting semaphores. The intuition for counting semaphores, it kept a count, and when the count was zero and you wanted to decrement the count, that we'd end up instead waiting until the count became not zero, became one or two. And it was always a positive count because we were counting like some object, like a library book or the number of threads that could do something, and that's how we would reason about how we would actually use this. So we gave one sort of very practical example of saying, let's say we had a bounded queue, and we wanted to do this producer-consumer pattern where some threads are adding things to the queue, some threads are removing things from the queue, and when the queue is full or empty, we want threads to wait as appropriate. We want a thread that's trying to add something to the queue to wait when it's full rather than just giving up. We want a thread that's trying to remove things from the queue to wait when it's empty rather than just giving up. And semaphores gave us a way to do this. So a pattern. Then we talked about starting our alternative to semaphores, which was monitors. So monitors, unlike semaphores, don't, as our textbook probably would complain, conflate the idea of waiting for an event to happen and ensuring that only one thread can do a thing at a time, that we have this object for monitors that represents the waiting on an event list called a condition variable, such as separate from locks, which work like our normal locks, rather than having one object with a count which we use for both of them. Okay, so any questions on these topics? Yeah?
Can I ask a question about the quiz?
Sure.
Can we go to the one where there's like A means X and B means S? The one that 3/4 of the class got wrong?
I need to check if I miskeyed the quiz. But let's look at, I have the quiz source file. So, 16, okay. So the question is, we had a processor A reads X, processor A reads X, processor B reads X. And the question is, how many times does processor A's copy updated or invalidated? So processor A read X, so it had to update its copy. Then processor B read X, which does nothing to processor A's copy. Then processor B wrote X, which invalidated A's copy. And the answer should have been 3 because I wasn't thinking of the read as an, yeah. Okay, so yes, people, I will rekey that. And what happened is I forgot, oh, reading is updating the copy. Yeah.
What if we assume that that initial read is not an update because it's already in memory?
It says that's not an
update. It says
the not. But why is that an update rather than, why is that?
The cache is updated because the value in the cache changes. Like previously, the cache block says invalid, no value that we can use. And that, then it says valid, there's a value. Then it says shared and a value we can use. The cacheable fact, because we have to fetch a copy from memory, the cache is not going to be able to take advantage of the fact that maybe some stray bits lying around happen to be the same in that part of the cache. If that's what you're thinking.
Well, I was confused because I think the semantics of updated are usually that something already exists and then you're updating it, rather than if it's not even there, you're not updating it, you're just loading it.
Okay, that could have been clearer, I guess. Though there's the issue of the value wasn't in the cache originally. Yeah, that could have been clearer. I agree. By updating, I meant anything which changes the state of the cache. But yes, that could have been clearer. Okay, so I'll rekey that quiz so it will look correct. And and I'll look through comments eventually on the actually incorrect answers. Yeah, so I just miscounted because I wasn't thinking when I wrote the key. Okay, so on other things that I messed up, I talked about binary semaphores and I showed you some not very good code for actually implementing binary semaphores with normal semaphores. So let me show you some actually correct code by doing the thing I should have done and like looking up what people have done for this. Because in the 80s, people published papers about this stuff. So here's a correct version. And this will help us go through some of the intuition for using semaphores that isn't so obvious about how do you use semaphores to do the waiting type operation that we're going to do with condition variables where you can wait on something and then signal the waiters. How do we implement that with semaphores? And this shows that pattern. So we have this gate, which is initially, we're going to say 1, assuming the count is positive. And we, on our down, we do the down operation on the gate. So we decrement from 1 to 0, yes?
I think your speaker turned off.
My speaker turned off. Meaning, oh, yeah, okay. So do the other way. Okay, so I guess we're using this mic, which hopefully will cooperate. So the idea is that the down operation is going to be called from our, you know, counting down. And the idea is that the gate says, can we let someone decrement now? So it's 1 if we can let one thread decrement now, 0 if we can let no threads decrement now. And we use this to say, let each thread go one at a time. So ordinarily, if the value is positive, it's going to be 1. And whenever we decrement the value, we set it to 0. We say, I'm using this gate. And then we figure out afterwards, oh, can another thread still go? Should it still be OK? And if so, we lift the gate and let the next thread go. And on the upside, we see, did we increment it to 1? We let another thread go, because now, because it was should have been 0 before, and now it's 1. And this is a common pattern that you see in a lot of semaphore using code, that you'll use these sorts of gates, where the gate is open with when the value is 1, the gate is closed when the value is 0, and you use the gate, and then you say, should I keep the gate open or not, because I just closed it by using it. So this is a very common pattern you'll see in semaphore using code, where they want to control who gets to do something. That hopefully illustrates how you can possibly use semaphores for things. Now, personally, I use mutexes and condition variables, which is why I wasn't super on top of this last time. Yes? Question?
So how would you do this with a counting semaphore rather than just one counting semaphore?
So the question is, how would you do this with a counting semaphore? So this is imitating a counting semaphore. This is sort of our counting down, counting up.
Right. So if you just had one counting semaphore, would you just use the down and the up in the same spots, but with a counting semaphore instead?
So if we had a counting semaphore, we could just do, the counting dot down, counting dot up, and say, so the whole method.
That's a whole method?
Okay, this is what the whole method is doing, yes. So your counting semaphore would be much simpler. Now, you can do everything that you do with binary semaphores, you can do with counting semaphores without changing anything. Because binary semaphores are just counting semaphores with the restriction we don't let the value go above 1. So it will work the same way. Other questions? So, okay, so that's on correcting my misstatements about how those binary semaphores works and giving you an actually correct example, I hope, unless I miscopied the code from old papers. How this works, that's well thought out and about as efficient as you can get for doing this. Okay, so last time we were talking about monitors. We mentioned our idea is that our monitor rather than having one thing we use for both our mutex, our sort of mutual exclusion, and our waiting for something, which we can see exactly here, we had our, this is our mutual exclusion, one at a time. And this was the wait for event piece that we split it up and we used the same object for both things to some sort of elegance. We're going to split that up into two separate objects, our locks, which handle the one at a time part, and our condition variables, which handle wait for something to happen. And the way this works is we have a lock. We're going to have some shared data related to the things we're waiting on. That's protected by this lock, meaning that we're going to always acquire the lock before we touch any of that data, reading or writing it. The lock, of course, has a queue of waiting threads. And we have these condition variables, which are additional queues of threads that aren't waiting to acquire the lock. They're waiting for something else to happen. Like in the case of our counting semaphore implementation, they're waiting for the count to become not zero anymore. And our condition variables have these three operations. So we had one operation, which is how do we add ourselves to the list? And this also takes our lock, because it's going to unlock our lock when we're added to the list, because otherwise no one would ever get to go and change, say, the condition we're waiting on, which is based on this shared data. So that's what wait does. So it unlocks the lock, so we're added to the condition variable queue, and someone waiting on the lock gets to go, and hopefully they change our condition. Like hopefully if we're waiting because of a down operation, implementing a semaphore, they're gonna do an up. So they'll let us go. And we had two mechanisms for letting threads go. So one is known as broadcast. And broadcast says everyone who's waiting for this condition variable should go right away. Well, we don't really mean right away because we have a lock for all our shared data. So they're all gonna wait for the lock, and when they get the lock, they're gonna be able to go. So they're gonna go as soon as they can get use of that shared data. And we also have signals where we choose one of them arbitrarily. Hopefully we choose like the one that's waiting the longest, but this is typically not actually guaranteed by real implementations. So we'll just choose one of them and let them go the next time they get a chance. Okay, and we had our usage example, which we finished up on last time, which here I have a finished variable, and I'm gonna wait for finished to become true. And unlike our sort of classic semaphore, you know, simple solution of implementing join, we're gonna have as many threads as they want can wait for finished, call wait for finished, and they'll all wait until finished is true. And the way we handle that is if finished isn't true, they add themselves to the condition variables list of waiting threads. And when we set finished to true, we also broadcast on that condition variable, meaning we move all those threads to the queue waiting for the lock. So they'll all acquire the lock. They'll all read our shared data, our finished variable, and find out, yes, it's true, and move on. And any threads which start waiting after we finished are just going to acquire the lock, look at the finished variable, say, I don't even need to wait, I'm done. And because we have a lock, before we access the finished variable, we don't need to worry about any of that memory order stuff, anything about compilers messing things up. That's all guaranteed by our lock, that we're not going to be confused about when the finished variable is set. So our typical timeline might look like this, that let's say we have two nearly simultaneous calls to wait for finish and finish. So let's say wait for finish calls it first. It checks, is finish true? No, it's not. So it starts waiting. And as it starts waiting, it releases the lock. So our thing which is trying to finish can actually get access to that shared variable. It can set it to true. It can signal the condition, broadcast on the condition variable. So this wait for finish thing, which started waiting earlier, now stops waiting for the condition variable and starts waiting for the lock. It can't get it yet because we haven't released it. Then we release the lock, it can get it, it double checks, and we'll talk about why it double checks, but it double checks that finished is false, or is true, and it finds out it is, so it returns. This timeline makes sense. Okay. So, and there's other possibilities. So another possibility I mentioned is that the finish thread could finish happen before we start waiting. That we don't actually require any particular order. So it sets finish to true. It broadcasts. Nothing happens because no one's waiting, but that's fine. And then it's done. Then later on, we acquire the mutex. We get our look at the finished variable, find out it's true. We don't even bother waiting. We just unlock. Okay, so questions so far? Okay, so we have one little mystery, which is why did we have this loop? And it seems unnecessary because we only broadcast on the condition variable if finish is true, and that seems like it's the only way that someone could stop waiting. So why, after we're done waiting, do we go back to the top of this while loop and check finished again, rather than just having this be an if statement? And one way you can find the answer is by reading the manual page for pthread conduit. And pthread conduit has this wonderful statement, spurious wake-ups may occur. And what that means is that wait can return even though absolutely nothing happened. So you might say, that's awfully annoying. Why did they do that? So there's sort of two justifications. So one is that it definitely makes it easier to implement wait. In particular, it makes it easier to implement, you know, more efficiently. You could implement it so this wouldn't ever occur, but it makes it easier to implement. The other justification is that we'll see in many real cases where we'll use condition variables that even if we had something where spurious wakeups didn't occur, we'll often need a loop anyways to work because we'll be worried about exactly who acquires the lock, and I'll show you an example of that later. There are systems which would avoid that, but we have to make our locks work in a different way than the locks we've already talked about in order to make that happen. But so basically, even thinking about this is making it easier to implement, but the cost is now we need to double check everything. Okay, so questions? So let's look at an example of a different use of this, of our mutexes and condition variables. And here I have an unbounded producer-consumer example. So I have a lock and a buffer, which is unbounded, so I don't have to worry about it filling up. I just have to worry about being empty. And I have a condition for is data ready yet? And the idea is that I'm going to take something that's waiting for data to be ready every time I insert something. So I'm going to enqueue an item, I'm going to signal data's ready. So first note that we're following our rule that we never touch buffer without acquiring the lock. In practice, this is really important. Not just because, well, how is buffer implemented? Is it a linked list? Are we updating the next pointer at the same time? If it's a dynamic array, are we reallocating the array at the same time from two different calls to produce or something like that? We don't want to worry about that. The lock keeps us from worrying. And I have this condition I'm testing, which is the buffer empty? And the idea is I check, is the buffer empty? If not, I wait and check again. And eventually I'll find out the buffer's empty, and immediately after that, I'm going to dequeue something from it. Note that I have the lock while I'm doing this. So either I have the lock because I just got it and executed the while loop for the first time and skipped it, or I have it because I returned from conduit, and when conduit returns, it reacquires the lock. So either way, I have the lock, So I don't need to worry about other threads sneaking in and dequeuing something else from the buffer after I check that it's empty. That's the only reason this is safe. If I wasn't locking, I'd be in trouble. Someone else might dequeue right there. And here I have the important thing. I have my con signal. I wake one consume thread if any are waiting. If none are waiting, it does nothing, but that's not a problem. And I can safely know I can wake one because I know every call to produce has a corresponding call to consume. So I'm going to wake the appropriate number of threads overall. I'm not going to worry about not waking up some thread. Okay, so questions on this code that uses condition variables. Yeah?
Just wondering, so if you dequeue from an empty queue, does it return, or does it say called? Or?
So the question is, what happens when I dequeue from an empty queue? I have not specified that because this is like pseudocode. And I haven't specified how exactly unbounded queue works. That's not the name of like a real C++ class.
Right.
So it depends, but helpfully I'm avoiding doing that with this code because I always check if it's empty first.
Consuming thread, because that's all we need to signal?
Yes.
So what if that consuming thread just for some reason chose not to dequeue something?
So the question is, what if that consuming thread chose not to dequeue something? Then this code would be wrong. Then we would need to do something other than signal to handle that case, or add something to that consuming thread. Yeah, this only works because we know that it's going to consume something. No, there's not going to be something else. So let's go through sort of what the timelines can look like for this. And I'm going to go through this loop here, and we're going to talk about how many times can that loop execute. So we're going to start with a simple case where our while buffer empty loop executes 0 times. So this is our simplest sort of what can happen with these condition variables. So in that case, we've already produced. So produce happens, it acquires the lock, it enqueues something, it signals. There's not another one waiting, so signal does nothing. Then it unlocks, then the consume happens, it locks, it checks if it's empty, it's not. Great, it skips the loop, executes it 0 times, dequeues something, and unlocks. So that's the simplest case, that we didn't actually need to wait, and we just check, do we need to wait? The answer is no. Then we have the case where we need to wait. So consume starts, but produce hasn't happened yet. So it consumes, it locks, it checks if it's empty, so it unlocks and starts waiting by calling con wait. And that means that produce, you know, eventually can come along, it can take the lock, which helpfully has been released. It can enqueue something, it can signal, so it's not waiting anymore, but it needs to get the lock. Then it unlocks, so then the consume thread, thread 2, can acquire the lock and ask, okay, is it empty now? And the answer is no. So we check if it's empty. So it's not empty, so we dequeue, unlock, and return. So this timeline makes sense. Okay. So let's talk about how we can have 2 iterations. And one case is if we had spurious wake-ups. So if we had these waking up for no reason, like that could happen here, like 20 times. But there's another case, which is interesting, where it can happen, which is one of the reasons why I talked about, you know, they designed spurious wakeups as a thing that they're just going to happen because it's hard to avoid, even if you didn't have spurious wakeups, having the loop. And that's this case. So here I have 2 threads calling consume. And what happens is our first thread calls consume, checks if it's empty. It is. It waits. Then someone starts producing, and it enqueues something, and signals, and we stop waiting. But someone else gets the lock. And you can see, why might that happen? Well, maybe our lock lets threads get it in the order they started waiting, and this consume thread started waiting earlier, according to it. So it gets it first, just because our lock happens to work that way. We didn't specify how the lock chooses who gets it when there's multiple waiting, and that's an implementation choice. So it gets the lock, it says, is it empty? Nope, it dequeues and unlocks, but our thread 2 here, when it gets the lock, well, thread 3 emptied it already, so it's still empty. So here we didn't have a spurious wake up, we just had the lock be acquired by someone else when we were woken up. So you could say, gosh, that doesn't make sense. Really, the thread that was signaled should get the lock next. And this is something that some implementations do. This is called poor scheduling, but it's not done by pthreads. And you can tell it's not done by pthreads because pthread consignal and conbroadcast don't ask you about the lock. They don't know what the lock is. So they can't do this. And this makes implementing the locks a lot easier, because if we had to support this with our locks, now all of a sudden our lock implementation has this extra case where we need to make sure we don't let someone else, the wrong thread, get the lock. So we could do this, and there have been real implementations which do, but pthreads doesn't do it, Java doesn't do it. I don't know of any current day threading library which does it. So they all have this pattern where instead you do this while double checking loop instead. And you have to do it even if there are no spurious wake ups because of this kind of situation where you're woken up but someone else sneaks in before you, you know, and does what you were about to do. And they just, the threading library just doesn't go through the effort of preventing that from happening. Questions about this scenario? Okay, so I mentioned this is called Hoare scheduler. The other kind is called Mesa style. This is named after Hoare is an auth person who designed the Hoare scheme, and Mesa was a system out of Xerox PARC, which used the scheme that most modern implementations use, which is that they just say, we want to use the fastest lock possible without caring about doing this handoff stuff. And that's why they work that way. Okay. So this is our unbounded buffer. And you can see our general pattern that we have something we signal or broadcast to and something where we wait looping on that condition. That's what we'll see over and over again. We'll have this while loop, while some condition that we're waiting to become, you know, not true anymore is true, keep waiting. And that's the pattern we'll use generally. And we can use this to extend from having our unbounded queue to a bounded queue. So here's my bounded queue case, and I just added some waiting and some signaling. So I said, okay, I'm not just going to produce unconditionally, I'm going to check, is the buffer full? And if so, I'm going to wait. So I have this extra condition variable, so I have a separate list of threads that are waiting for the buffer to have space. And they're waiting while it's full. And after I consume, after I dequeue something, I signal that because I know one thread, I freed up one slot in the buffer, so one thread can go now. So this question's on this code? Okay, so something that's worth noting that's going to be true generally in code that uses condition variables is that I have room to be sloppy. So here I'm signaling exactly one thread because I've thought about this carefully and realized, oh, every time I dequeue, there's exactly one in queue which will happen at most. So signaling is fine. But if I don't want to think about that, I could just replace this with a broadcast, and it's going to be correct. It's going to be slower, because we're going to have more times where producers that are waiting are going to check this and find out, oh, it's full again. But it's going to be correct. And this is arguably a nice thing, because it makes it easier to write code which will do the right thing. Because if you don't think about it, you just use broadcast, and you're never going to get that wrong. arguably it's bad because it encourages you to write code which does more checking of things that we should have known were going to be true. So another thing I could have done that I didn't is I could have said that I don't want to use two condition variables. I just want to have one queue of threads that are waiting for anything. And what I'm going to do is I'm just going to broadcast instead of signaling on that. So they'll all check, well, something changed. Is it the thing I was waiting for? And I can absolutely do that. And it's just more double checking things. So it's going to be correct. It's just going to be slower. So this is another type of sloppiness we have. So if you want to produce a correct implementation with monitors, you can always do this, start with this pattern where you just say, wait on something and broadcast whenever you might have changed that something, rather than being very precise about waking up exactly one thing at a time and so on. And you'll have correct code, it just will be slower code. And I like thinking about things this way because it makes it easier to develop monitor code that you can, you know, start with the sloppy solution and then say, well, I don't want to actually be waking up all these things that don't need to wake up. Let's split this up into more condition variables and work in that sort of incremental way. Okay, so questions on these sloppiness ideas? So our general pattern with monitors is that we'll acquire a lock, we'll have something we're waiting for, we'll have a condition variable for it, we'll wait on that. And then after we change show data, before we release the lock, we're gonna say, did we maybe set the condition? If so, we'll broadcast, and so on each of the condition variables that matter. So this is our sort of generic pattern that we're going to use to write code that uses monitors. And so you just construct condition variables for each possible thing you need to wait for. You can split it up as much as you want to. And you make sure you, whenever you change that condition, you at least you broadcast or do something equivalent to that. Okay. So that's sort of our monitor. So we have our shared data. So we acquire a lock to access some shared data. We check some condition while holding that lock and possibly manipulate data based on the condition we checked. So like in our produce case, we checked, is there space in the buffer? You know, is the buffer full? And if not, only then we added without releasing the lock. So we knew the buffer wasn't full when we were adding data. So we just hold the lock for the entire operation, and we have condition variables when we need to wait. So we have a condition variable for every kind of thing we need to wait for. We wait on the condition variable, and we make sure every time we change the shared data, we think about which conditions changed, and make sure we broadcast to all those condition variables. And we have these sloppinesses that we can use, is that if you're worried, should I signal here? Well, it's always safe to use broadcast just slow. If you're worried about, I'm not sure if I actually changed something, well, you can always broadcast when nothing has changed because they'll double check the condition anyways. It will be correct, but slow. So there are things you can do which are correct, but you should avoid if you can think about them. But in complicated cases, you might say, well, I'm not really sure what happened here. You can do the just in case thing. And like at least make know it's correct code, and then you can worry later on about, well, do I really need to do this all the time? And fix that later. Okay, so questions? Okay, so those are sort of the summary of what monitors look like. So let's go through exercise here. So I have here's my unbounded produce consume code. But I want to change this from having consume to having a consume to. Which is going to return a pair of values, so two values from the queue. And I want to be able to have two consume to calls happen at once and not have any problems. So for example, if I produce two items and then call consume two twice from two different threads, I want one of them, exactly one of them to return. I don't want it to be the case that both of them are waiting forever. So how do I do this with monitors? I'll give you a minute to sort of sketch what that would look like. You can maybe check with a neighbor to see if you agree. So who needs more time? Okay, can someone give me something I should do? Like maybe not everything, but something, some change I should make to do this, yeah. Okay, so we're gonna have two items that we dequeue, so we're gonna also have item two equals dequeue here. Okay. That's something we're gonna do. And then we're going to return not item, but presumably a pair of them. Okay, so what other changes do we need? So that's the non-synchronization part. Yeah?
Well, buffer.size.
So buffer.size, so instead of buffer.empty, we're going to have this be buffer.size is less than 2. And this turns out to be enough. Now it's true, sometimes we're signaling and we can't go. Because the buffer now has one item, we signal because we just produced an item, and the consume two thread wakes up and finds out, oh, the buffer's still not full. But that's not a problem for correctness, it's just slow. Now, we could probably do something where we fix that by adding some sort of, where we like made that more efficient, but this is sort of, you know, faster, but not needed for correctness. Yeah?
Would that require another condition variable in order to ensure that it's correct?
The question is, would it require another condition variable to ensure it's correct? So if we're replacing consume with consume two, then we're just changing what the condition variable means. If we still had consume, yes, we would need another condition variable. So here I'm assuming we're replacing consume with consume two. So there's no more consume. So data ready means two things are ready instead of one. But if we still wanted to have consume, then we'd have one another condition variable instead.
Yeah, sorry, but what I mean is like in that if statement, so I mean there's like an if statement before you signal, right?
Yes.
Does that if statement need to take a condition variable or can it just take a boolean?
So the question is, does it need to take a condition variable? So remember, so one thing that's important about condition variables is they aren't actually booleans. Like you can't use them in an if statement. there are things you wait on or stop people from waiting on, but we don't want to wait when we're producing, ever. After we've added something, that is. Once we've added something to the queue, we're not waiting. So we definitely don't wait on the condition variable. The only thing we might do is signal or broadcast no more. And yes, it is a surprisingly common mistake for people to really, really want condition variables to be like variables, which like hold values like Booleans. They do not. They're related to a Boolean. So the way I would think of this data ready, you can think of this as being the list for buffer.size less than 2. It's the list of threads that care about that. It's not, is that true or not? It's the list of threads that care. And I'm sorry, the name condition variable is pretty confusing because it's very sensible that you really want it to be like a condition, like a Boolean, because that sounds like what it is, but it's just a bad name in that respect. It's not a name where you would guess its functionality based on the name. Other questions? Yeah.
Can you go over the if statement?
So the if statement, so there's various things we could imagine doing. So one thing we can definitely do is we can only signal if the size is greater than 1, because we know no one will ever want to wake up from consume 2 if the size is 0. That would be the simplest thing we could do. There might be some more sophisticated things we can do, but you'd have to reason carefully about like, will we ever miss a case where we should have woken someone up? But you could imagine like, is there an odd or even number of items in the buffer? It might be another thing we might be able to look at. Yeah, but most obviously we cannot signal when there's only one thing in the buffer and we know no one cares. Okay, other questions? Okay, so we talked about monitors, and when I initially introduced monitors, I mentioned them. I said that they were as powerful as semaphores. And let's actually show that that's true by building a semaphore, a counting semaphore, with monitors. So let's do that. And I'm just going to go through the step-by-step process, the sort of thing I would use if I need to solve some sort of synchronization problem with monitors. So the first step is I know I'm going to have a lock for some shared data. So I write my lock to protect the shared state, and you think about what is the shared data I care about for this problem? Well, I have a counting semaphore. Counting semaphore has a count, so it's going to be exactly that count. Because that's what the semaphore tracks, that's what we're going to want to wait based on. Depending on what the count is, we might want to wait sometimes or not. So that's the shared state we care about. Then I need to think about what things are we going to wait for? And the question is, we're going to wait for the count to become not zero anymore. Because sometimes we're going to try to use the down operation, the count's going to be zero, and we're going to want it to become one before we do anything. So we have a condition variable for, is the count positive? And that's the only scenario we wait. Up never actually waits for anything. It just changes the count and possibly causes other things to stop waiting. So down is the only operation which waits. That's the thing it's waiting for to be true. So we have a condition variable for that, which is the list of things which care about that becoming true. So then we have our down operation. And our pattern is we acquire the lock, we check our condition that we want to wait for. So while the count is not positive, I'm going to wait for the count to become positive. And we know that sometimes we're going to wait, we're going to be woken up, and we're going to find out that it's still not positive. So we have a while loop to check for that. Then after we know it's positive, we decrement it, and we know we're keeping it positive, keeping it non-negative, because it was a worst one. and we unlock. Okay, so questions so far? So then we have our up, and I call, I lock this shared lock, I increment the count, and then I signal the count's positive now. You might say, maybe I should check if, you know, it moved it from 0 to 1. So I don't, that doesn't really matter, because if you think about it, what's con signal going to check? It's going to check, is anyone waiting? Anyways, it has to check that regardless. So I'm just going to signal unconditionally and rely on it, like, quickly checking, is the queue empty? Okay. And I know it's safe to use signal because we know each time we call up, at most one thread can finish a down that would have been waiting otherwise. So questions on the code I have here? Okay, so let's say, you know, you might say, okay, you're signaling here and you've like carefully reasoned that I can just wake up one thread if multiple are waiting, and that's nice. Let's say I didn't do that and I wanted to like check if the condition became true. I can do that. I can say, did we go from 0 to 1? If so, everyone was waiting because it was 0, so now they should stop waiting, and I broadcast to do that. Okay, so this is an alternate implementation that works. Now, you might say, well, if it just went from 0 to 1, that means one thing can go. Why am I broadcasting? Can't I just signal? And that's a very reasonable assumption. Like, we should just signal there. But if you do that, you'll find out it doesn't work. And it's pretty subtle why. So I'll give you some time to think about that. And the hint here is, think of two threads calling down and two calling up at the same time. Give you a minute to think about it. I would work out like what the timeline looks like to figure out why can't that be signal? What would go wrong if that was signal? Okay, does someone, people want more time to think about it? It's not. So I have a potential timeline here. So let's say the count's initially 0. So thread 1 calls down, starts waiting. Thread 2 calls down, starts waiting. then thread 3 calls up, increments the count, it's now 1, so it's going to signal. That was what we're checking. But we have here, this is an example of, you know, this is MESA style scheduling still. You know, we don't hand off the lock. So no handoff of the lock. So instead, thread 4, which is called up, gets the lock first, rather than handing it off to the thread we just signaled. And it increments the count. The count's not 1, so it doesn't signal. And the thread we woke up from the signal wakes up and decrements the count to 1, but our thread 2 here is left waiting forever. And this is a problem which would have been avoided if we didn't have this MESA-style scheduling, but that's what we're left with. So does this timeline make sense? So there are two ways of avoiding this. So one is what we did, is that we just signaled all the time, and we just said, well, hey, it's going to check if the queue's empty or not. That's fine. If there's anything on the queue, it, you know, something should go. Even if we're making the count go from 1 to 2, like you saw in this example. That when we do that, we actually do want something to go, so it made sense to signal, even though the count wasn't going from 0 to 1, because we could sneak in before the downs happened. So another solution would be that we could say, after we call down, we could say, does someone else need to go right away? And we could check there. That would be another way to solve this problem. I would probably use this solution. But this is a big subtlety that comes up, you know, is that you still need to think about these orders when you're trying to say, I can use signal here, or I can check if we just change the condition, not if it's true. You need to be careful. And, you know, the big thing is when you use signal, you need to be really concerned, what if more than one thread is waiting, what could happen? And is it really the case that we're guaranteed that the other threads that are waiting are going to know about it? And in this case, the answer was no, because other things could call up before the count became 0 again. So questions about this example?
What are the downsides then to using broadcast all the time?
So what are the downsides to using broadcast? So another solution would have been to here, use broadcast here and not have this code. Or rather, yeah, our original code was using broadcast. So this code here, if we had one thread, two threads calling down and one calling up, then we wake up both even if there was no other call to up. So we're waking up an extra thread that we don't need to. And if we had like 10 threads calling down, we'd be waking up 10 of them. So like that can scale really badly. And that's why we want to try to use signal when there's an easy way of doing it. But the easy way of doing it is to not worry about, did we just change from 0 or 1? That's not what we worry about. We just say, every time we up, maybe one thread can down, and that's why I'm signaling. You know, one thread, not more than one thread for every up. But if we use signal here, in this case, we're saying one thread can go call down every time the count goes from 0 to 1, which isn't true. We can have more than one thread per time the count goes from 0 to 1 because the count can go to 2 to 3 to 4 to 5 in the meanwhile. Other questions? Okay, so let's go in the other direction. So I showed you that we can use monitors to implement semaphores, but that just shows you that monitors are at least as powerful as semaphores. Doesn't show you that semaphores are at least as powerful as monitors, but we can go the other way around. And this is actually a lot trickier. So let's look at implementing the two components we had for monitors with Semaphore. So one component was locks. That's easy. I believe it was our first Semaphore example. Let's do condition variables. So condition variables are a lot harder. How do we implement condition variables with monitors? And the reason they're harder is because we have this sort of who's waiting now that we worry about for condition variables, not this history. So we can do the simple thing where we use the up operation, or sorry, the down operation when we wait, and we use the up operation, so this is down, I'm using the POSIX name, so I'm sorry, up. But this means that if we signal and no one's waiting, that we're gonna wake someone up later on. Much later on, potentially, like hours later. So this works, but it has spurious wake-ups. And potentially a lot of spurious wake-ups. So this is a correct implementation just for signal. You notice I haven't done broadcast yet, so that seems problematic. But just for signal, that works, but it has a lot of spurious wake-ups. So can we make that better? And the way we make that better is that we're gonna follow the pattern we saw implementing counting semaphores using binary semaphores. So we're gonna have a lock implemented using semaphores and some extra state. So our condition variable is gonna have a lock that's implemented with a semaphore, and this extra state, which is how many threads are actually waiting. And now our wait operation is get the lock, increment the number of waiting threads. And then release the lock with the number of waiting threads incremented, then release our main lock, because we know someone won't signal us until that happens, so that's fine. And now wait on our single semaphore that represents that. Do the down operation to wait for what we were previously waking up for, but now is the signal, instead of unconditionally calling the up operation on that, how many threads do we want to wake up, and waking up threads way in the future, we're gonna check, is anyone waiting now? And if so, then we're gonna wake someone up and decrement that count, keeping track of it. So this idea makes sense. So we keep track of the count of waiters. We use a lock to make sure we don't get confused about what that count is. The lock we can implement with a semaphore if we want to. And then we check if the count's greater than zero, and that's how we avoid waking things up way far in the future. And if we're keeping track of the number of things waiting, we also have a way of implementing broadcast now. That to implement broadcast, we can just keep track of the number of waiters and use the up operation that many times to correspond to each down operation and each waiting thread, and wake up everyone who's waiting when we first check the number of waiters. Questions on? See here? Yeah.
Should broadcast take in the main lock?
Shouldn't broadcast take in the main lock? No. If you remember our POSIX API, our broadcast only took in the condition variable. And we're doing the same thing. And the assumption is you generally have the lock when you're doing that, though that's not actually required by POSIX. But I would recommend writing code that way. But yeah, we don't, as you can see, this implementation, we don't actually care about the main lock. We only care about this lock, which is all this stuff here is part of the condition variable. So this would be, if this was implementing POSIX condition variables, this would be part of the pthread conti struct or whatever. Yeah?
So I guess the signal is not very different from the broadcast?
So the signal is, sorry, yeah, the signal in broadcast, the difference is whether you have a loop with this design, because now we have we know how much we need to loop for. We know the number of things we need to wake up. Other questions? Okay, so as monitors with semaphores. So I'll skip over that for now at least. So let's go over another common problem that comes up all the time when we're writing multi-threaded code. So one thing we went over is we went over producer-consumer, that we have some threads adding things to a queue, some threads removing them, and it turns out a lot of code really looks like this. Another thing which happens all the time is we have some shared data, and we want to ensure that when that data is being modified, that only one thread's doing it. But typically the data is not being modified, and it's read-only, and we'd like multiple threads to read it at once. We don't want to have everyone wait just to read some data that's not changing. And so there's an abstraction for this that's sort of a generalization of a lock. So a lock would do this, except it would only allow one reader at a time, which is going to work, but it's going to be slow. So we have this abstraction known as a reader-writer lock. And we have two types of lock operations here. So we have read locks, which wait until there's no writers. And read unlock is just stop being registered as a reader. So as many threads as you want can call read lock as long as no one tries to write. Then we have a write lock, which waits until there's no readers and no writers. And write unlock, which stops that. So write lock is only one at a time. Read lock is as many people can have a read lock at a time as they want. Okay, so this is a useful construct. And it's so useful, in fact, that POSIX has an implementation of it in pthreads. So POSIX has this thing called RW locks, which are exactly this interface. So you create an RW lock, kind of like a mutex, and there's a read lock operation, which multiple people can read lock something, and there's a write lock operation, which is one thread at a time. Okay. And this is something which is relatively simple to implement with monitors, in fact. So you could, if you didn't have this in the pthreads library, you could write something like this yourself. And as we'll see, you can customize how it works if you don't like the choices that pthreads make for when how the reader and writer lock works. So here, let's go through creating this with monitors. So first, we're going to have some lock to protect our shared state. That's where we always started. And our shared state needs to tell us when do we wait. And if you remember when I stated my conditions for waiting, it's no readers and writers or no writers. So I'm going to track the information I need to know about waiting, which is how many readers and writers are there now. So that's how I'm going to know whether I need to wait or not. And I'm going to have two conditions that I'm waiting for. I have the condition, are there no writers right now, so I can read. Or are there no readers and writers, so I can write? So I can implement my operations based on that. So I have my read lock. While there's no writers, I wait for there to be for it to be okay to read. And when I write, when I'm done writing, I signal, hey, it's okay to read now, because I just decremented the number of writers to zero. I broadcast, in fact, it's okay to read because all the readers should go. And similarly, when I'm done writing, I signal, oh, it might be okay to write now because I know there's no readers, because I checked this earlier. when I acquired the write lock, I knew when I returned from write lock, readers plus writers was one with one writer. So I know there's no readers, and I know there's now no writers since I just decremented that, so it should be okay to write. So in that case, we signal okay to write for this waiting up here. Also, when we're done reading, if there's no readers anymore, we can signal okay to write, one writer can go. Because maybe the number of writers was definitely zero, and if the number of readers is now zero, then we know that this condition might be true now. Readers plus writers might be equal to zero instead of not equal to zero. Might have changed. That makes sense. So this is working code that will implement a reader-writer lock. Now, there's a bit of an issue here, which is we wake up when we finish writing. We say, OK, when we finish writing, readers is zero and writers is zero. That means readers can go and writers can go. And our solution is let's wake them all up and let them fight it out when they try to get the lock and hope that works out. So this will work, it will be correct, but maybe we could do better. So before I move on to doing better, any questions about like how this works, why it, you know, hopefully is correct so far? Yeah. So the issue I'm talking about here is this works, but we're waking up, if we have writers and readers waiting, we're waking up all of them. And whoever gets the lock first gets to go.
Sorry. What is the...
Oh, the overall problem? So the idea is we want to allow as many threads to call read as, to do a read lock as possible. So if a thread calls read lock, they increment the number of readers. And as many threads can do that as they want, and while that's happening, no one can write. And if someone starts writing, they only do that if no one else is reading or writing. This was our problem that I stated here. So read lock waits till there's no writers. We don't want to read when someone's writing. We want as many people to read as possible at once. And write lock is we wait until no reading or writing because we, when we're writing, we don't want anyone else to see what's going on or interfere with that. That makes sense? And so the conditions we're checking are if there's no writers, we can read. If there's no readers or writers, we can write. And we do that before we return from read lock or write lock, and we don't change that until we have the corresponding unlock call. But we have this issue that we're just saying that when we're done writing, it's okay to read, it's okay to write right now, and we're just going to wake all those threads up and hopefully the right one will go first. And this will work, but maybe we want to make a better choice. So there's a policy question here. We can have this writers first or readers first. So if writers first, this means that when we're done writing, if there's a writer waiting, we want that writer to go right away. And we might do this because if we don't do that, then any reader is going to stop that writer from ever getting to go, you know, potentially for a very long time. And readers first, we're going to say, we don't want writers to hold up people waiting to read. I care about having lots of threads read at once. So I'm going to have writers wait until no one's interested in reading, even though that might take a while. And the previous implementation is just, let's let what happen happens with however the lock works. And we know the lock, who knows what the lock does. And we want to make an explicit decision, and this is something that we can do. So the decision we want to make is going to be based on whether there's a reader or writer waiting. So observe, when I wrote down the condition, I said, writers first, we want no readers to go if a writer is waiting. So now that I've written down that condition, I'm going to add state to check for it. So if I want to know if a writer is waiting, I'm going to track how many writers are waiting. I'm going to track that explicitly. So I'm going to add a variable, how many writers are waiting. and I'm going to check it in two places. So one place, the most important place I'm going to check it, is readers, when they're determining whether to go, they're not just going to check, are there no writers? They're going to check, are there no waiting writers either? If they're waiting writers, they're not going to go. They're going to say, no, you told our policy is when someone writer is waiting, I don't read. Yeah. So the question is, does this change the functionality if a reader, because readers and writers, readers are trying to read information changed by the writers? The idea is that the reader gets to read at some point in time, and it gets a version of the data while it's reading. What we're concerned about is we don't want someone to say, you know, read a class list and say, find out there's 37 students, but a list of 36 student names. We want them to get 37 students and 37 student names. You know, that's what we're concerned about. They don't see inconsistencies. And so this is what that looks like. So here, I'm tracking the number of waiting writers. So to track it, before I start waiting from write lock, before starting to write, I say, I'm starting waiting, then I do my loop for waiting, and when I'm done with that, I decrement to say, I'm not waiting anymore, there's one less writer waiting. And for my read lock, I say, readers don't go unless there's no waiting writers. And these things at the top, these are the necessary changes. These make my policy happen. In addition, I can observe, okay, now that I'm checking this way, I can use, now that I have this waiting writers, I can know that that if there's a waiting writer, then I signal the okay to write, otherwise I don't need to wake up the readers at all. It would be correct to, they would just go back to sleep again, but we really prefer not to. And now we have a variable to exactly know when that's okay to do. So, questions? Here. So with this relatively simple change, I just choose a policy about who gets to go, and this is a common pattern you'll see with monitors, that when you want threads to go in a particular order, you just add some state to track who should go now. Thinking about who's waiting and so on, you can track that information explicitly yourself and use that to make decisions like this. And we can do this sort of in the opposite way. So let's say we want the reader priority version. I want to say if someone's asking to read, they go before writers go. So I can do this in the opposite way, where I say, okay, we're going to keep track of how many readers are waiting, and we're going to check that before we write. Before we start writing, we're going to say, we're only going to start writing if no one's waiting to read. And correspondingly, if no one's waiting to read, we signal a writer. Otherwise, only if someone's waiting to read is it worth broadcasting that it's okay to read. Yes?
Well, out of these three choices, what do POSIX need when it has
issues? So the question is, what do POSIX reader writer locks do? And they don't specify. And it probably varies on what OS you're on. Okay. So that's where I'll leave off for today. So I'll see you next week.